as witnesses to my decision. A king indeed, Catelyn thought, defeated. She could only hope that the trap he'd planned for Moat Cailin worked as well as the one in which he'd just caught her.
Samwell.
White Tree, Sam thought. Please, let this be White Tree.
He remembered White Tree. White Tree was on the maps he'd drawn on their way north. If this village was White Tree, he knew where they were.
Please, it has to be.
He wanted that so badly that he forgot his feet for a little bit. He forgot the ache in his calves and his lower back, and the stiff frozen fingers he could scarcely feel. He even forgot about Lord Mormont and Craster, and the Whites and the others.
White Tree,
Sam prayed, to any god that might be listening. All wildling villages look much alike, though. A huge weirwood grew in the centre of this one, but a white tree did not mean White Tree necessarily. Hadn't the weirwood at White Tree been bigger than this one? Maybe he was remembering it wrong. The face carved in the bone-pale trunk was long and sad. Red tears of dried sap leaked from its eyes.
Was that how it looked when we came north?
Sam couldn't recall. Around the tree stood a handful of one-room hovels, with sod roofs, a long hall built of logs and grown over with moss, a stone well, a sheepfold. But no sheep, nor any people. The wildlings had gone to join Mance Rayder in the Frostfangs, taking all they owned except their houses. Sam was thankful for that. Night was coming on, and it would be good to sleep beneath a roof for once. He was so tired, it seemed as though he had been walking half his life. His boots were falling to pieces, and all the blisters on his feet had burst and turned to callus. But now he had new blisters under the callus, and his toes were getting frostbitten. But it was either walk or die, Sam knew. Gilly was still weak from childbirth, and carrying the babe besides. She needed the horse more than he did. The second horse had died on them 3 days out from Craster's keep. It was a wonder she lasted that long, poor half-starved thing. Sam's weight had probably done for her. They might have tried riding double, but he was afraid the same thing would happen again.
It's better that I walk.
Sam left Gilly in the long hall to make a fire while he poked his head into the hovels. She was better at making fires. He could never seem to get the kindling to catch, and the last time he'd tried to strike a spark or flint and steel, he managed to cut himself on his knife. Gilly bound up the gash for him, but his hand was stiff and sore, even clumsier than it had been before. He knew he should wash the wound and change the binding, but he was afraid to look at it. Besides, it was so cold that he hated taking off his gloves. Sam did not know what he hoped to find in the empty houses. Maybe the wildlings had left some food behind. He had to take a look. John had searched the huts at White Tree on their way north. Inside one hovel, Sam heard a rustling of rats from a dark corner, but otherwise there was nothing in any of them but old straw, old smells, and some ashes beneath the smoke hole. He turned back to the weirwood and studied the carved face a moment.
"It is not the face we saw," he admitted to himself. "The tree's not half as big as the one at White Tree."
The red eyes wept blood, and he didn't remember that either. Clumsily, Sam sank to his knees.
"All gods, hear my prayer. The seven were my father's gods, but I said my words to you when I joined the watch. Help us now. I fear we might be lost. We're hungry, too, and so cold. I don't know what gods I believe in now, but please, if you're there, help us. Gilly has a little son."
That was all he could think to say. The dusk was deepening, the leaves of the weirwood rustling softly, waving like a thousand blood-red hands. Whether John's gods had heard him or not, he could not say. By the time he returned to the long hall, Gilly had the fire going. She sat close to it, with her furs opened, the babe at her breast.
"He's as hungry as we are," Sam thought.
The old women had smuggled out food for them from Craster's, but they had eaten most of it by now. Sam had been a hopeless hunter, even at Horn Hill, where game was plentiful, and he had hounds and huntsmen to help him. Here, in this endless, empty forest, the chances of him catching anything were remote. His efforts at fishing the lakes and half-frozen streams had been dismal failures as well.
"How much longer, Sam?"
Gilly asked.
"Is it far still?" "Not so far, not so far as it was."
Sam shrugged out of his pack, eased himself awkwardly to the floor, and tried to cross his legs. His back ached so abominably from the walking that he would have liked to lean up against one of the carved wooden pillars that supported the roof, but the fire was in the centre of the hall beneath the smoke hole, and he craved warmth even more than comfort.
"Another few days should see us there."
Sam had his maps, but if this wasn't White Tree, then they weren't going to be much use.
"We went too far east to get around that lake," he fretted, "and maybe too far west when I tried to double back."
He was coming to hate lakes and rivers. Up here there was never a ferry or bridge, which meant walking all the way around the lakes and searching for places to ford the rivers. It was easier to follow a game trail than to struggle through the brush, easier to circle a ridge instead of climbing it.
"If Bannon or Daywin were with us, we'd be at Castle Black by now, warming our feet in the common room."
Bannon was dead, though, and Daywin gone with Gren and Dolorous Ed and the others.
"The wall is 300 miles long and 700 feet high,"
Sam reminded himself. If they kept going south, they had to find it, sooner or later. And he was certain that they had been going south. By day he took directions from the sun, and on clear nights they could follow the ice dragon's tail, even though they hadn't travelled much by night since the second horse had died. Even when the moon was full, it was too dark beneath the trees, and it would have been so easy for Sam or the last Garen to break a leg.
"We have to be well south by now. We have to be."
What he wasn't so certain of was how far east or west they might have strayed. They would reach the wall, yes, in a day or a fortnight. It couldn't be farther than that, surely.
Surely. But where?
It was the gate at Castle Black they needed to find, the only way through the wall for 100 leagues.
"Is the wall as big as Craster used to say?"
Gilly asked.
"Bigger,"
Sam tried to sound cheerful.
"So big you can't even see the castles hidden behind it. But they're there, you'll see. The wall is all ice, but the castles are stone and wood. There are tall towers and deep vaults and a huge long hall with a great fire burning in the hearth day and night. It's so hot in there, Gilly, you'd hardly believe it. Could I stand by the fire, me and the boy? Not for a long time, just till we get good and warm." "You can stand by the fire as long as you like. You'll have food and drink, too. Hot mulled wine and a bowl of venison stewed with onions, and Hobb's bread right out of the oven, so hot you'll burn your fingers."
Sam peeled off a glove to wriggle his own fingers near the flames, and soon regretted it. They had been numb with cold, but as feeling returned, they hurt so much he almost cried.
"Sometimes one of the brothers will sing," he said, to take his mind off the pain. "Darien sang best, but they sent him to Eastwatch. There's still Halder, though, and Toad. His real name is Tudder, but he looks like a toad, so we call him that. He likes to sing, but he has an awful voice."
"Do you sing?" Gilly rearranged her furs as she moved the babe from one breast to the other. Sam blushed.
I know some songs. When I was little, I liked to sing. I danced too, but my Lord Father never liked me to. He said if I wanted to prance about, I should do it in the yard with a sword in me hand.
Could you sing some Southern song for the babe?
If you like,
Sam thought for a moment.
There's a song our Septon used to sing to me and my sisters when we were little and it was time for us to go to sleep. The Song of the Seven, it's called.
He cleared his throat and softly sang.
The father's face is stern and strong. He sits and judges right from wrong. He weighs our lives the short and long and loves the little children. The mother gives the gift of life and watches over every wife. Her gentle smile ends all strife, and she loves her little children. The warrior stands before the foe, protecting us where'er we go. With sword and shield and spear and bow, he guards the little children. The crone is very wise and old, and sees our fates as they unfold. She lifts her lamp of shining gold to lead the little children. The smith, he labours day and night to put the world of men to right. With hammer, plough, and fire bright, he builds for little children. The maiden dances through the sky. She lives in every lover's sigh. Her smiles teach the birds to fly and give dreams to little children. The seven gods who made us all are listening if we should call. So close your eyes, you shall not fall. They see you, little children. So close your eyes, you shall not fall. They see you, little children.
Sam remembered the last time he'd sung the song with his mother, to lull baby Dickon to sleep. His father had heard their voices and come barging in angry.
"I will have no more of that,"
Lord Randall told his wife harshly.
"You ruin one boy with those soft Septon songs. Do you mean to do the same to this babe?"
Then he looked at Sam and said, "Go, sing to your sisters if you must sing. I don't want you near my son." Gilly's babe had gone to sleep. He was such a tiny thing, and so quiet that Sam feared for him. He didn't even have a name. He had asked Gilly about that, but she said it was bad luck to name a child before he was two. So many of them died. She tucked her nipple back inside her furs.
"That was pretty, Sam. You sing good. You should hear Darien. His voice is sweet as mead. We drank the sweetest mead the day Craster made me a wife. It was summer then, and not so cold."
Gilly gave him a puzzled look.
"Did you only sing of six gods? Craster always told us you Southerns had seven." "Seven," he agreed, "but no one sings of the stranger."
The stranger's face was the face of death. Even talking of him made Sam uncomfortable.
"We should eat something, a bite or two."
Nothing was left but a few black sausages, as hard as wood. Sam sawed off a few thin slices for each of them. The effort made his wrist ache, but he was hungry enough to persist. If you chewed the slices long enough, they softened up and tasted good. Craster's wives seasoned them with garlic. After they had finished, Sam begged her pardon and went out to relieve himself and look after the horse. A biting wind was blowing from the north, and the leaves and the trees rattled at him as he passed. He had to break the thin scum of ice on top of the stream so the horse could get a drink.
"I had better bring her inside."
He did not want to wake up at break of day to find that their horse had frozen to death during the night.
"Gilly would keep going even if that happened."
The girl was very brave, not like him. He wished he knew what he was going to do with her back at Castle Black. She kept saying how she'd be his wife if he wanted. But Black Brothers didn't keep wives. Besides, he was a Tarly of Horn Hill. He could never wed a wildling.
"I'll have to think of something, so long as we reach the wall alive. The rest doesn't matter. It doesn't matter one little bit."
Leading the horse to the long hall was simple enough. Getting her through the door was not. But Sam persisted. Gilly was already dozing by the time he got the Garen inside. He hobbled the horse in a corner, fed some fresh wood to the fire, took off his heavy cloak, and wriggled down under the furs beside the wilding woman. His cloak was big enough to cover all three of them, and keep in the warmth of their bodies. Gilly smelled of milk and garlic and musty old fur, but he was used to that by now. They were good smells, so far as Sam was concerned. He liked sleeping next to her. It made him remember times long past, when he had shared a huge bed at Hornhill with two of his sisters. That had ended when Lord Randall decided it was making him soft as a girl.
"Sleeping alone in my own coal cell never made me any harder or braver, though."
He wondered what his father would say if he could see him now.
"I killed one of the others, my lord," he imagined saying. "I stabbed him with an obsidian dagger, and my sworn brothers call me Sam the Slayer now."
But even in his fancies, Lord Randall only scowled, disbelieving. His dreams were strange that night. He was back at Hornhill, at the castle, but his father was not there. It was Sam's castle now. Jon Snow was with him, Lord Mormont too, the old bear, and Gren, and Dolorous Edd, and Pip, and Toad, and all his other brothers from the Watch, but they wore bright colours instead of black. Sam sat at the high table and feasted them all, cutting thick slices off a roast with his father's great sword Heartsbane. There were sweet cakes to eat and honeyed wine to drink. There was singing and dancing, and everyone was warm. When the feast was done, he went up to sleep, not to the lord's bedchamber where his mother and father lived, but to the room he had once shared with his sisters. Only instead of his sisters, it was Gilly waiting in the huge, soft bed, wearing nothing but a big shaggy fur, milk leaking from her breasts. He woke suddenly, in cold and dread. The fire had burned down to smouldering red embers. The air itself seemed frozen. It was so cold. In the corner, the Garen was whinnying and kicking the logs with her hind legs. Gilly sat beside the fire, hugging her babe. Sam sat up, groggy, his breath puffing pale from his open mouth. The long hall was dark with shadows, black and blacker. The hair on his arms was standing up.
"It's nothing," he told himself. "I'm cold, that's all."
Then by the door, one of the shadows moved. A big one.
"This is still a dream," Sam prayed. "Oh, make it that I'm still asleep. Make it a nightmare. He's dead. He's dead. I saw him die." "He's come for the babe," Gilly wept. "He smells him. A babe fresh born stinks of life. He's come for the life."
The huge dark shape stooped under the lintel, into the hall, and shambled toward them. In the dim light of the fire, the shadow became Small Paul.
"Go away," Sam croaked. "We don't want you here."
Paul's hands were cold. His face was milk. His eyes shone a bitter blue. Hoarfrost whitened his beard, and on one shoulder hunched a raven, pecking at his cheek, eating the dead white flesh. Sam's bladder let go, and he felt the warmth running down his legs.
"Kelly, calm the horse and lead her out. You do that."
"You," she started, "I have the knife, the dragonglass dagger."
He fumbled out as he got to his feet. He'd given the first knife to Gren, but thankfully he remembered to take Lord Mormont's dagger before fleeing Craster's keep. He clutched it tight, moving away from the fire, away from Gilly and the babe.
"Paul!"
He meant to sound brave, but it came out in a squeak.
"Small Paul, do you know me? I'm Sam, Fat Sam, Sam the Scared. You saved me in the woods. You carried me when I couldn't walk another step. No one else could have done that, but you did.
Sam backed away, knife in hand, snivelling.
I am such a coward. Don't hurt us, Paul, please. Why would you want to hurt us?
Gilly scrabbled backward across the hard dirt floor. The white turned his head to look at her, but Sam shouted, "No!" and he turned back. The raven on his shoulder ripped a strip of flesh from his pale, ruined cheek. Sam held the dagger before him, breathing like a blacksmith's bellows. Across the long hall, Gilly had reached the garren.
"God, give me courage," Sam prayed. "For once, give me a little courage, just long enough for her to get away."
Small Paul moved toward him. Sam backed off until he came up against a rough log wall. He clutched the dagger with both hands to hold it steady. The white did not seem to fear the dragon glass. Perhaps he did not know what it was. He moved slowly, but Small Paul had never been quick, even when he'd been alive. Behind him, Gilly murmured to calm the garren and try to urge it toward the door, but the horse must have caught a whiff of the white's queer, cold scent. Suddenly she balked, rearing, her hooves lashing at the frosty air. Paul swung toward the sound and seemed to lose all interest in Sam. There was no time to think or pray or be afraid. Sam Tarwell threw himself forward and plunged the dagger down into Small Paul's back. Half-turned, the white never saw him coming. The raven gave a shriek and took to the air.
"You're dead!" Sam screamed as he stabbed. "You're dead! You're dead!"
He stabbed and screamed again and again, tearing huge rents in Paul's heavy black cloak. Shards of dragon glass flew everywhere as the blade shattered on the iron mail beneath the wall. Sam's wail made a white mist in the black air. He dropped the useless hilt and took a hasty step backwards as Small Paul twisted around. Before he could get out his other knife, the steel knife that every brother carried, the white's black hands locked beneath his chins. Paul's fingers were so cold they seemed to burn. They burrowed deep into the soft flesh of Sam's throat.
"Run, Gilly, run!"
He wanted to scream, but when he opened his mouth, only a choking sound emerged. His fumbling fingers finally found the dagger, but when he slammed it up into the white's belly, the point skidded off the iron links, and the blade went spinning from Sam's hand. Small Paul's fingers tightened inexorably and began to twist.
"He's gonna rip my head off," Sam thought in despair.
His throat felt frozen, his lungs on fire. He punched and pulled at the white's wrists, to no avail. He kicked Paul between the legs uselessly. The world shrank to two blue stars, a terrible, crushing pain, and a cold so fierce that his tears froze over his eyes. Sam squirmed and pulled, desperate, and then he lurched forward. Small Paul was big and powerful, but Sam still outweighed him, and the whites were clumsy. He had seen that on the fist. The sudden shift sent Paul staggering back a step, and the living man and the dead one went crashing down together. The impact knocked one hand from Sam's throat, and he was able to suck in a quick breath of air before the icy black fingers returned. The taste of blood filled his mouth. He twisted his neck around, looking for his knife, and saw a dull orange glow.
The fire!
Only ember and ashes remained, but still, he could not breathe or think. Sam wrenched himself sideways, pulling Paul with him. His arms flailed against the dirt floor, groping, reaching, scattering the ashes, until at last they found something hot, a chunk of charred wood, smouldering red and orange within the black. His fingers closed around it, and he smashed it into Paul's mouth, so hard he felt teeth shatter. Yet even so, the white's grip did not loosen. Sam's last thoughts were for the mother who had loved him and the father he had failed. The long hall was spinning around him when he saw the wisp of smoke rising from between Paul's broken teeth. Then the dead man's face burst into flame, and the hands were gone. Sam sucked in air and rolled feebly away. The white was burning, hoarfrost dripping from his beard as the flesh beneath blackened. Sam heard the raven shriek, but Paul himself made no sound. When his mouth opened, only flames came out, and his eyes.
"It's gone. The blue glow is gone."
He crept to the door. The air was so cold that it hurt to breathe, but such a fine, sweet hurt. He ducked from the long hall.
"Gilly!" he called. "Gilly! I killed her! Gil—"
She stood with her back against the weirwood, the boy in her arms. The whites were all around her. There were a dozen of them, a score, more. Some had been wildlings once, and still wore skins and hides, but more had been his brothers. Sam saw Lark the Sisterman, Softfoot, Riles. The wen on Chet's neck was black, his boils covered with a thin film of ice. And that one looked like Hake, though it was hard to know for certain, with half his head missing. They had torn the poor Garen apart, and were pulling out her entrails with dripping red hands. Pale steam rose from her belly. Sam made a whimpering sound.
"It's not fair."
"Fair!"
The raven landed on his shoulder.
"Fair! Far! Fear!"
It flapped its wings and screamed along with Gilly. The whites were almost on her. He heard the dark red leaves of the weirwood rustling, whispering to one another in a tongue he did not know. The starlight itself seemed to stir, and all around them the trees groaned and creaked. Sam Tarly turned the color of curdled milk, and his eyes went wide as plates.
Ravens!
They were in the weirwoods, hundreds of them, thousands, perched on the bone-white branches, peering between the leaves. He saw their beaks open as they screamed, saw them spread their black wings. Shrieking, flapping, they descended on the whites in angry clouds. They swarmed around Chet's face and pecked at his blue eyes. They covered the sister man like flies. They plucked gobbets from inside Hake's shattered head. There were so many that when Sam looked up, he could not see the moon.
"Go!"
said the bird on his shoulder.
"Go! Go! Go!"
Sam ran, puffs of frost exploding from his mouth. All around him, the whites flailed at the black wings and sharp beaks that assailed them, falling in an eerie silence with never a grunt nor cry. But the ravens ignored Sam. He took Gilly by the hand and pulled her away from the weirwood.
"We have to go." "But where?"
Gilly hurried after him, holding her baby.
"They killed our horse. How will we—"
"Brother!"
The shout cut through the night, through the shrieks of a thousand ravens. Beneath the trees, a man, muffled head to heels, in mottled blacks and greys, sat astride an elk.
"Here!"
the rider called. A hood shadowed his face.
"He's wearing blacks."
Sam urged Gilly toward him. The elk was huge, a great elk, 10 feet tall at the shoulders, with a rack of antlers near as wide. The creature sank to his knees to let them mount.
"Here!"
the rider said, reaching down with a gloved hand to pull Gilly up behind him. Then it was Sam's turn.
"My thanks!" he puffed.
Only when he grasped the offered hand did he realize that the rider wore no glove. His hand was black and cold, with fingers hard as stone. Arya. When they reached the top of the ridge and saw the river, Sandor Clegane reined up hard and cursed. The rain was falling from a black iron sky, pricking the green and brown torrent with 10,000 swords.
"It must be a mile across," Arya thought.
The tops of 50 trees poked up out of the swirling waters, their limbs clutching for the sky like the arms of drowning men. Thick mats of sudden leaves choked the shoreline, and farther out in the channel she glimpsed something pale and swollen, a deer or perhaps a dead horse, moving swiftly downstream. There was a sound, too, a low rumble at the edge of hearing, like the sound a dog makes just before he growls. Arya squirmed in the saddle and felt the links of the hound's mail digging into her back. His arms encircled her. On the left, the burned arm, he'd done a steel vambrace for protection. But she'd seen him change the dressings, and the flesh beneath was still raw and seeping. If the burns pained him, though, Sandor Clegane gave no hint of it.
"Is this the Blackwater Rush?"
They had ridden so far, in rain and darkness, through trackless woods and nameless villages, that Arya had lost all sense of where they were.
"It's a river we need to cross. That's all you need to know."
Clegane would answer her from time to time, but he had warned her not to talk back. He had given her a lot of warnings that first day.
"The next time you hit me, I'll tie your hands behind your back," he said. "The next time you try and run off, I'll bind your feet together. Scream or shout or bite me again and I'll gag you. We can ride double, or I can throw you across the back of my horse, trussed up like a sow for slaughter. Your choice."
She had chosen to ride, but the first time they made camp, she'd waited until she thought he was asleep and found a big, jagged rock to smash his ugly head in. "Quiet as a shadow," she told herself as she crept toward him. But that wasn't quiet enough. The hound hadn't been asleep after all. Or maybe he'd woken. Whichever way it was, his eyes opened, his mouth twitched, and he took the rock away from her as if she were a baby. The best she could do was kick him.
"I'll give you that one," he said, when he flung the rock into the bushes, "but if you're stupid enough to try again, I'll hurt you."
"Why don't you just kill me like you did Micah?"
Arya had screamed at him. She was still defiant then, more angry than scared. He answered by grabbing the front of her tunic and yanking her within an inch of his burned face.
"The next time you say that name, I'll beat you so bad you'll wish I'd killed you."
After that, he rolled her in his horse blanket every night when he went to sleep, and tied ropes around her top and bottom, so she was bound up as tight as a babe in swaddling clothes.
"It has to be the Blackwater,"
Arya decided, as she watched the rain lash the river. The hound was Joffrey's dog. He was taking her back to the Red Keep to hand to Joffrey and the Queen. She wished that the sun would come out, so she could tell which way they were going. The more she looked at the moss on the trees, the more confused she got.
"The Blackwater wasn't so wide at King's Landing, but that was before the rains."
"The fords will all be gone," Sandor Clegane said, "and I wouldn't care to try and swim over neither."
"There's no way across," she thought. "Lord Beric will catch us for sure."
Clegane had pushed his big black stallion hard, doubling back thrice to throw off pursuit, once even riding half a mile up the center of a swollen stream. But Arya still expected to see the outlaws every time she looked back. She had tried to help them by scratching her name on the trunks of trees when she went in the bushes to make water, but the fourth time she did it, he caught her, and that was the end of that.
"It doesn't matter," Arya told herself. "Thoris will find me in his flames."
Only he hadn't. Not yet, anyway. And once they crossed the river...
"Harroway Town shouldn't be far," the hound said, "where Lord Root stables old King Andahar's two-headed waterhorse. Maybe we'll ride across."
Arya had never heard of old King Andahar. She'd never seen a horse with two heads either, especially not one who could run on water. But she knew better than to ask. She held her tongue and sat stiff as the hound turned the stallion's head and trotted along the ridgeline following the river downstream. At least the rain was at their backs this way. She'd had enough of it stinging her eyes, half blind, and washing down her cheeks like she was crying.
"Wolves never cry," she reminded herself again.
It could not have been much past noon, but the sky was dark as dusk. They had not seen the sun in more days than she could count. Arya was soaked to the bone, saddle sore, sniffling and aching. She had a fever, too, and sometimes shivered uncontrollably, but when she told the hound that she was sick, he only snarled at her.
"Wipe your nose and shut your mouth," he told her.
Half the time he slept in the saddle now, trusting his stallion to follow whatever rutted farm track or game trail they were on. The horse was a heavy courser, almost as big as a destrier, but much faster.
"Stranger," the hound called him.
Arya had tried to steal him once, when Clegane was taking a piss against a tree, thinking she could ride off before he could catch her. Stranger had almost bitten her face off. He was gentle as an old gelding with his master, but otherwise he had a temper as black as he was. She had never known a horse so quick to bite or kick. They rode beside the river for hours, splashing across two muddy vassal streams before they reached the place that Sandor Clegane had spoken of.
"Lord Haraway's town," he said, and then when he saw it, "Seven Hells."
The town was drowned and desolate. The rising waters had overflowed the river banks. All that remained of Haraway town was the upper story of a daub and wattle inn, the seven-sided dome of a sunken sept, two-thirds of a stone round tower, some mouldy thatch roofs, and a forest of chimneys. But there was smoke coming from the tower, Arya saw, and below one arch window a wide, flat-bottomed boat was chained up tight. The boat had a dozen oarlocks and a pair of great carved wooden horses' heads mounted fore and aft. The two-headed horse, she realized. There was a wooden house with a sod roof right in the middle of the deck, and when the hound cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted, two men came spilling out. A third appeared in the window of the round tower, clutching a loaded crossbow.
"What do you want?"
he shouted across the swirling brown waters.
"Take us over!"
the hound shouted back. The men in the boat conferred with one another. One of them, a grizzled grey-haired man with thick arms and a bent back, stepped to the rail.
"It will cost you."
"Then I'll pay."
With what? Arya wondered. The outlaws had taken Clegane's gold. But maybe Lord Beric had left him some silver and copper. A ferry ride shouldn't cost more than a few coppers. The ferrymen were talking again. Finally the bent-back one turned away and gave a shout. Six more men appeared, pulling up hoods to keep the rain off their heads. Still more squirmed out of the holdfast window and leapt down onto the deck. Half of them looked enough like the bent-backed man to be his kin. Some of them undid the chains and took up long poles, while the others slid heavy, wide-bladed oars through the locks. The ferry swung about and began to creep slowly toward the shallows, oars stroking smoothly on either side. Sandor Clegane rode down the hill to meet it. When the aft end of the boat slammed into the hillside, the ferryman opened a wide door beneath the carved horse's head and extended a heavy oaken plank. Stranger balked at the water's edge, but the hound put his heels into the courser's flank and urged him up the gangway. The bent-backed man was waiting for them on deck.
"Wet enough for you, sir?"
he asked, smiling. The hound's mouth gave a twitch.
"I need your boat, not your bloody wit."
He dismounted and pulled Arya down beside him. One of the boatmen reached for Stranger's bridle.
"I wouldn't,"
Clegane said, as the horse kicked. The man leapt back, slipped on the rain-slick deck, and crashed onto his ass, cursing. The ferryman with a bent back wasn't smiling any longer.
"We can get you across," he said sourly. "It will cost you a gold piece, another for the horse, a third for the boy."
"Three dragons?"
Clegane gave a bark of laughter.
For 3 dragons, I should own the bloody ferry.
Last year might be you could, but with this river, I'll need extra hands on the poles and oars just to see we don't get swept 100 miles out to sea. Here's your choice. 3 dragons, or you teach that hell horse how to walk on water.
I like an honest brigand. Have it your way. 3 dragons, when you put us ashore, safe on the north bank.
I'll have them now, or we don't go.
The man thrust out a thick, calloused hand, palm up. Clegane rattled his longsword to loosen the blade in the scabbard.
Here's your choice. Gold on the north bank, or steel on the south.
The ferryman looked up at the hound's face. Ari could tell that he didn't like what he saw there. He had a dozen men behind him, strong men with oars and hardwood poles in their hands, but none of them were rushing forward to help him. Together they could overwhelm Sandor Clegane, though he'd likely kill 3 or 4 of them before they took him down.
"How do I know you're good for it?"
the bent-back man asked after a moment.
"He's not,"
she wanted to shout. Instead, she bit her lip.
"Knight's honour,"
the hound said, unsmiling.
"He's not even a knight."
She did not say that either.
"That will do," the ferryman spat. "Come on, then. We can have you across before dark. Tie the horse up. I don't want him spooking when we're underway. There's a brazier in the cabin if you and your son want to get warm."
"I'm not his stupid son,"
said Arya furiously. That was even worse than being taken for a boy. She was so angry that she might have told them who she really was. Only Sandor Clegane grabbed her by the back of the collar and hoisted her one-handed off the deck.
"How many times do I need to tell you to shut your bloody mouth?"
He shook her so hard her teeth rattled. Then he let her fall.
"Get in there and get dry, like the man said."
Arya did as she was told. The big iron brazier was glowing red, filling the room with a sullen, suffocating heat. It felt pleasant to stand beside it, to warm her hands and dry off a little bit, but as soon as she felt the deck move under her feet, she slipped back out through the forward door. The two-headed horse eased slowly through the shallows, picking its way between the chimneys and rooftops of Drowned Harroway. A dozen men labored at the oars, while 4 more used the long poles to push off whenever they came too close to a rock, a tree, or a sunken house. The bent-back man had the rudder. Rain pattered against the smooth planks of the deck and splashed off the tall, carved horseheads fore and aft. Arya was getting soaked again, but she didn't care. She wanted to see. The man with the crossbow still stood in the window of the round tower she saw. His eyes followed her as the ferry slid by underneath. She wondered if this was Lord Root that the hound had mentioned. He doesn't look much like a lord. But then she didn't look much like a lady either. Once they were beyond the town and out in the river proper, the current grew much stronger. Through the grey haze of rain, Arya could make out a tall stone pillar on the far shore that surely marked the ferry landing. But no sooner had she seen it than she realized they were being pushed away from it downstream. The oarsmen were rowing more vigorously now, fighting the rage of the river. Leaves and broken branches swirled past as fast as if they had been fired from a scorpion. The men with the poles leaned out and shoved away anything that came too close. It was windier out here, too. Whenever she turned to look upstream, Arya got a face full of blowing rain. Stranger was screaming and kicking as the deck moved underfoot.
"If I jumped over the side, the river would wash me away before the hound even knew that I was gone."
She looked back over her shoulder and saw Sandor Clegane struggling with his frightened horse, trying to calm him. She would never have a better chance to get away from him.
"I might drown, though."
John used to say that she swam like a fish, but even a fish might have trouble in this river. Still, drowning might be better than King's Landing. She thought about Joffrey and crept up to the prow. The river was murky brown with mud and lashed by rain, looking more like soup than water. Arya wondered how cold it would be. I couldn't get much wetter than I am now. She put a hand on the rail. But a sudden shout snapped her head about before she could leap. The ferrymen were rushing forward, poles in hand. For a moment she did not understand what was happening. Then she saw it. An uprooted tree, huge and dark, coming straight at them. A tangle of roots and limbs poked up out of the water as it came, like the reaching arms of a great kraken. The oarsmen were backing water frantically, trying to avoid a collision that could capsize them or stove their hull in. The old man had wrenched the rudder about, and the horse at the prow was swinging downstream, but too slowly. Glistening brown and black, the tree rushed toward them like a battering ram. It could not have been more than 10 feet from their prow when two of the boatmen somehow caught it with their long poles. One snapped, and the long, splintering crack made a sound as if the ferry were breaking up beneath them. But the second man managed to give the trunk a hard shove, just enough to deflect it away from them. The tree swept past the ferry with inches to spare, its branches scrabbling like claws against the horse head. Only just when it seemed as if they were clear, one of the monster's upper limbs dealt them a glancing thump. The ferry seemed to shudder, and Arya slipped, landing painfully on one knee. The man with the broken pole was not so lucky. She heard him shout as he stumbled over the side. Then the raging brown water closed over him, and he was gone in the time it took Arya to climb back to her feet. One of the other boatmen snatched up a coil of rope, but there was no one to throw it to.
"Maybe he'll wash up some place downstream," Arya tried to tell herself,
but the thought had a hollow ring. She had lost all desire to go swimming. When Sandor Clegane shouted at her to get back inside before he beat her bloody, she went meekly. The ferry was fighting to turn back on course by then, against a river that wanted nothing more than to carry it down to the sea. When they finally came ashore, it was a good 2 miles downriver of their usual landing. The boat slammed into the bank so hard that another pole snapped, and Arya almost lost her feet again. Sandor Clegane lifted her onto Stranger's back, as if she weighed no more than a doll. The boatman stared at them with dull, exhausted eyes, all but the bent-back man who held his hand out.
"Six dragons," he demanded, "three for the passage and three for the man I lost."
Sandor Clegane rummaged in his pouch and shoved a crumpled wad of parchment into the boatman's palm.
"There, take 10. "10?
The ferryman was confused.
"What's this now?" "A dead man's note, good for 9,000 dragons, or nearabouts."
The hound swung up in the saddle behind Arya and smiled down unpleasantly.
10 of it is yours. I'll be back for the rest one day, so see you don't go spending it."
The man squinted down at the parchment.
"Writing? What good's writing? You promised gold. Knight's honour, you said." "Knight's? Have no bloody honour. Time you learn that, old man."
The hound gave Stranger the spur and galloped off through the rain. The ferryman threw curses at their backs, and one or two threw stones. Clegane ignored rocks and words alike, and before long they were lost in the gloom of the trees, the river a dwindling roar behind them.
"The ferry won't cross back till morning," he said, "and that lot won't be taking paper promises from the next fools to come along. If your friends are chasing us, they're going to need to be bloody strong swimmers."
Arya huddled down and held her tongue. "Velar Magullus," she thought sullenly. "Sir Ilion, Sir Merin, King Joffrey, Queen Cersei, Dunstan, Polliver, Raff the Sweetling, Sir Gregor, and the Tickler, and the Hound, The hound. The hound. By the time the rain stopped and the clouds broke, she was shivering and sneezing so badly that Clegane called a halt for the night and even tried to make a fire. The wood they gathered proved too wet, though. Nothing he tried was enough to make the spark catch. Finally, he kicked it all apart in disgust.
"Seven bloody hells," he swore. "I hate fires."
They sat on damp rocks beneath an oak tree, listening to the slow patter of water dripping from the leaves as they ate a cold supper of hard bread, mouldy cheese, and smoked sausage. The hound sliced the meat with his dagger, and narrowed his eyes when he caught Arya looking at the knife.
"Don't even think about it."
"I wasn't," she lied. He snorted to show what he thought of that, but he gave her a thick slice of sausage. Arya worried it with her teeth, watching him all the while.
"I never beat your sister," the hound said, "but I'll beat you if you make me. Stop trying to think up ways to kill me. None of it will do you a bit of good."
She had nothing to say to that. She gnawed on the sausage and stared at him coldly.
"Hard as stone," she thought. "At least you look at my face. I'll give you that, you little she-wolf. How'd you like it?"
"I don't. It's all burned and ugly." Clegane offered her a chunk of cheese and the point of his dagger.
"You're a little fool. What good would it do you if you did get away? You'd just get caught by someone worse."
"I would not," she insisted. "There is no one worse."
"You never knew my brother. Gregor once killed a man for snoring. His own man."
When he grinned, the burn side of his face pulled tight, twisting his mouth in a queer, unpleasant way. He had no lips on that side, and only the stump of an ear.
"I did so know your brother."
Maybe the mountain was worse, now that Arya thought about it. "Him, and Dunson, and Polliver, and Raptor Sweetling, and the Tickler." The hound seemed surprised.
"And how would Ned Stark's precious little daughter come to know the likes of them? Gregor never brings his pet rats to court."
"I know them from the village." She ate the cheese and reached for a hunk of hard bread. "The village by the lake, where they caught Gendry, me, and Hot Pie. They caught Lummy Greenhands, too, but Raff the Sweetling killed him because his leg was hurt."
Clegane's mouth twitched. "Caught you? My brother caught you?"
That made him laugh, a sour sound, part rumble and part snarl.
"Gregor never knew what he had, did he? He couldn't have, or he would have dragged you back, kicking and screaming, to King's Landing and dumped you in Cersei's lap. Oh, that's bloody sweet. I'll be sure and tell him that before I cut his heart out."
It wasn't the first time he had talked of killing the mountain.
"But he's your brother,"
Arya said dubiously.
"Didn't you ever have a brother you wanted to kill?"
He laughed again.
"Or maybe a sister?"
He must have seen something in her face then, for he leaned closer.
"Sansa, that's it, isn't it? The wolf bitch wants to kill the pretty bird."
"No," Arya spat back at him.
"I'd like to kill you." "Because I hacked your little friend in two? I've killed a lot more than him, I promise you. You think that makes me some monster? Well, maybe it does. But I saved your sister's life, too. The day the mob pulled her off her horse, I cut through them and brought her back to the castle, else she would have gotten what Lolly Stoutworth got. And she sang for me. You didn't know that, did you? Your sister sang me a sweet little song."
"You're lying," she said at once.
"You don't know half as much as you think you do. The Blackwater! Where in Seven Hills do you think we are? Where do you think we're going?"
The scorn in his voice made her hesitate.
"Back to King's Landing," she said. "You're bringing me to Joffrey and the Queen."
That was wrong, she realized all of a sudden, just from the way he asked the questions. But she had to say something.
"Stupid, blind little wolf bitch!"
His voice was rough and hard as an iron rasp.
"Bugger Joffrey, bugger the Queen, and bugger that twisted little gargoyle she calls a brother. I'm done with their city, done with their Kingsguard, done with Lannisters. What's a dog to do with lions, I ask you?"
He reached for his waterskin, took a long pull. As he wiped his mouth, he offered the skin to Arya and said,
"The river was a trident, girl. The trident, not the black water. Make the map in your head, if you can. On the morrow, we should reach the King's Road. We'll make good time after that. Straight up to the twins. It's going to be me who hands you over to that mother of yours. Not the noble lightning lord, or that flaming fraud of a priest, the Munster."
He grinned at the look on her face.
"You think your outlaw friends are the only ones can smell a ransom? Dondarrion took my gold, so I took you. You're worth twice what they stole from me, I'd say. Maybe even more, if I sold you back to the Lannisters like you fear. But I won't. Even a dog gets tired of being kicked. If this young wolf has the wits the guards gave a toad, he'll make me a lordling, and beg me to enter his service. He needs me, though he may not know it yet. Maybe I'll even kill Gregor for him. He'd like that."
"He'll never take you," she spat back.
"Not you." "Then I'll take as much gold as I can carry, laugh in his face, and ride off. If he doesn't take me, he'd be wise to kill me, but he won't. Too much his father's son, from what I hear. Fine with me. Either way, I'll win, and so do you, she-wolf. So stop whimpering and snapping at me. I'm sick of it. Keep your mouth shut and do as I tell you, and maybe we'll even be in time for your uncle's bloody wedding."
John. The mare was blown, but John could not let up on her. He had to reach the wall before the Magnar. He would have slept in the saddle, if he'd had one. Lacking that, it was hard enough to stay a horse while awake. His wounded leg grew ever more painful. He dare not rest long enough to let it heal. Instead, he ripped it open anew each time he mounted up. When he crested a rise and saw the brown, rutted King's Road before him wending its way north through hill and plain, he patted the mare's neck and said, "Now all we need to do is follow the road, girl. Soon the wall." His leg had gone as stiff as wood by then, and fever made him so light-headed that twice he found himself riding in the wrong direction. Soon the wall. He pictured his friends drinking mulled wine in the common hall. Hub would be with his kettles, Donald Noy at his forge, Maester Aemon in his rooms beneath the rookery, and the old bear, Sam Gren, Dolorous Ed, Dywin, with his wooden teeth. John could only pray that some had escaped the fist. Ygritte was much in his thoughts as well. He remembered the smell of her hair, the warmth of her body, and the look on her face as she slit the old man's throat. "You were wrong to love her," a voice whispered. "You were wrong to leave her," a different voice insisted. He wondered if his father had been torn the same way when he'd left John's mother to return to Lady Catelyn. He was pledged to Lady Stark, and I am pledged to the Night's Watch. He almost rode through Molestown, so feverish that he did not know where he was. Most of the village was hidden underground. Only a handful of small hovels to be seen by the light of the waning moon. The brothel was a shed no bigger than a privy, its red lantern creaking in the wind, a bloodshot eye peering through the blackness. John dismounted at the adjoining stable, half stumbling from the mare's back as he shouted two boys awake. "I need a fresh mount, with saddle and bridle," he told them, in a tone that brooked no argument. They brought him that. A skin of wine as well, and half a loaf of brown bread. "Wake the village," he told them. "Warn them.
There are wildlings south of the wall. Gather your goods and make for Castle Black." He pulled himself